This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. How to stop the slide of species toward extinction. Nearly 1,000 plants and animals are listed as endangered species here in the United States. And around the world, as you might guess, the numbers are even more dramatic. Worldwide, nearly 12,000 plants and animals are listed as threatened. And when we lose those plants and animals to extinction, we don't only lose a life, we lose a time capsule in a way, because evolution shaped these organisms and locked in their genomes is a record of the adaptations the plants and animals have accumulated over evolutionary time, information that might help us and other organisms not just to survive, but to thrive. So this hour, we're going to take a look at how scientists are working to bank the genetic information stored in plants and animals. Can we keep some endangered organisms in storage? How about that, in storage, while scientists work out a plan to reintroduce them to the wild? And what can we learn about evolutionary relationships by looking at DNA? We're going to also take a look at efforts to store the genetic information of some plants that aren't in danger of extinction, but they are important nonetheless. Food plants such as corn, watermelon, sugar beets. How can having a library of genetic material help farmers make the most of their crops? Warehousing genetic information might even help us save common trees and plants from devastating diseases. Plus, what does it take to store a seed for 1,000 years? That's longer than our lifetimes. How do we store a seed for 1,000 years? That'll be an interesting question to talk about. We're going to be talking about all these issues this hour. We're broadcasting from Denver, Colorado, from the site of the annual meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. And if you're here in our audience in Denver, I invite you to step up to the microphones. You have a microphone here, a microphone there, and ask your questions. Don't be afraid. If you don't ask them early, you may not get them in later because there'll be that long line after somebody may ask that first question. So let me introduce my panelists here, starting at the end of the table. On that end, we have Oliver Ryder. He is the head of genetics division at the Center for Reproduction of Endangered Species at the Zoological Society of San Diego. The San Diego Zoo, right? Yeah, okay. He is also an adjunct professor of biology at the University of California, San Diego. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Ryder.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
You're welcome. Christina Walters is the research leader of the Plant Germplasm Preservation Research Unit at the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Agriculture Research Services National Center for Genetic Resources Preservation in Fort Collins, Colorado, just a short piece from here. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Walters, today.
Hi, it's nice to be here.
I'm not going to go through that whole thing again.
It's a hard name for us, too.
Catherine Kennedy is the president and executive director of the Center for Plant Conservation. That's hosted by the Missouri Botanical Gardens in St. Louis. Thank you for joining us today, Dr. Kennedy.
Happy to be here.
We've been out to your gardens in the past, and we enjoyed visiting them. Let me start with you. We hear a lot about endangered species, and we think of animals, but we don't usually think of plants. We think we have too many plants, but there are endangered plants. Tell us about that.
Yes, there are. I think a lot of people think that endangered species are a rainforest problem.
Right.
And they're not. We have a number of endangered species right here in our country. And further compounding that, I think many people don't realize the magnitude of the problem we have with our own flora. And in fact, we have almost 900 species of Native American plants that are already federally listed as endangered or threatened or qualify for listing but have not yet made it through the process. And that is approaching 5% of our flora. And we have an additional load of species that are of conservation concern that we believe may need some intervention. And that number approaches 10% of our flora. So we really have a real problem with vulnerability to extinction and loss of plant resources right here at home.
And so what does the Center for Plant Conservation try to do to reverse all of this?
Well, we actually are a nonprofit institution that's a network of botanic gardens, arboreta, museums, academic institutions that have all joined the network and have agreed to follow good science practice and to work hands-on for plant conservation. So every institution that's a part of the CPC network is working actively to conserve and restore the imperiled plants of the United States.
Do you actually go out looking for these endangered plants?
Absolutely.
And collect seeds or saplings or
yep.
what?
We collect seed and plant material and we bank it and save it for research and for use in restoration. Our aim is to provide the plant material that we'll need to do the restoration in the wild and to return these species to robust and self-sustaining status.
Where do you find these species that are they around the, you know, our homes, or are they in the forest? Where are all these?
Every state in the union has endangered species, and what we do is we work with our institutions, with the state heritage programs, with the Fish and Wildlife Service, to identify the highest priority species that are in need of conservation action, and then our institutions take on the commitment of working with those species in their area. And they really are making a big commitment, because the recovery process for listed plants can be 20 or 25 years or more before you get through the process. So they're making a big commitment when they say, yes, our institution will work for these with these species from our area. We'll try to get the job done.
Christina Walters, what types of plant genetic diversity are you interested in preserving?
We are USDA, so...
Is that everything?
That mandate actually is to preserve genetic diversity of agronomically important species. And that can be defined very broadly of plants that have current or potential economic importance and all of their wild relatives.
So mostly crops for farmers, things like that?
Absolutely, yeah.
But we don't think of them as... being endangered or disappearing. What do you mean preserving them?
The crops aren't endangered. We have a very healthy agricultural business in the United States. But where all those crops come from in the centers of origin are usually from someplace else, because when Americans emigrated to the United States, they brought their seeds with them. And so those wild populations, those are the populations that have all those valuable genes and adaptations for disease resistance,
right,
and insects. That's what we're trying to preserve.
Do they still grow in spots around the country, or the original, crop of wild populations, or are they gone? Are they being tilled up, or are they? Can you find them easily
in the United States?
Yeah.
The wilds are there. Are some congeners? They're related to our species, but most of their agronomic species come from a different part of the world. Soybeans come from Manchuria. Sorghum comes from Africa.
So do you get these? You go over there. You have people bring them over. Or you collect those.
I don't get to, but we have a lot of collectors who do.
All right. Let me ask you, Dr. Ryder. How does the work you do with animals differ from collecting or preserving species of plants? Well, we're not talking about seeds here, right?
We're not talking about seeds. Animal reproduction depends on, until recently, you couldn't reproduce animals vegetatively, which was something that plants can do. You can take a cutting. So the continuity of gene pools to preserve these adaptations really requires reproduction of animals. So knowledge of declining gene pools is also involved with knowledge about the state of populations and their fragmentation.
Mm-hmm. So you bank the genetic diversity also? You're trying to preserve it?
We started banking cells to do studies so we could better characterize the genetic diversity of endangered species. Chromosomes vary between even closely related mammals, and to identify whether an animal was a hybrid or a pure of its type is the kind of study that can be done. Or should the ones in one geographic region be bred separately from ones in another geographic region? By preserving these cells, we also preserve access to their DNA and the enzymes that are in the cells, and be able to allow the chromosomal studies as well. And so it's produced a quite an important resource for looking at genetic diversity and better characterizing what's there. One of the great difficulties with endangered species is that we stand in ignorance of their biology. And now, increasingly, they're very valuable and increasingly powerful tools that are available for understanding the biology of organisms through, for example, genomic studies. And that will be probably continue to be so in the future. But what's decreasing is the ability to actually have material to study as species become more endangered, as populations disappear.
All of us who visited the San Diego Zoo see the normal zoo, we see the animals out there, but you have something called a frozen zoo. Tell us about the frozen zoo.
We have a repository that's over 25 years old now that has frozen and viable cells from many endangered species. There are over 6,500 individual animals represented in this collection now. It corresponds to over 400 species and subspecies. It includes mostly mammals, but we now are beginning to put a few birds and reptiles into the collection.
And this is to preserve their DNA, the cells?
This is preserving the living cells. They're skin cells, actually, fibroblasts they're called. So they're cells that can be stored in liquid nitrogen that are held in suspended animation. They can be thawed and growing in 20 minutes and dividing. And from that, you can obtain chromosomes, or you can obtain intact nuclei, or you can obtain DNA.
Hmm. Let's see if we get a quick call from a quick call, quick audience question here from before we have to go to our break. Go ahead.
My name is Allison. I'm from the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville. Obviously, we've seen a move toward banning human cloning. I wondered if cloning of animal or plant species figured into their preservation of these endangered species. And are there any regulations or restrictions on such cloning?
That's an area where policy is currently being developed. Right now, we have permits that allow us to hold endangered species and to propagate their cells and to send them to other people for research purposes that are relevant to conservation. But if the nuclei from these cells are used in cloning, then and an offspring produces, then all of a sudden somebody needs a permit for an endangered species, or do they? So that's an area where permit policy needs to be probably evolved. I think it's important to remember that cloning is very new technology. It's inefficient right now. We could discuss the potential applications of cloning in the conservation effort. And if we were to do that, in a nutshell, I'd say the real point would be to conserve the gene pool of a species, not to just make copies of animals. It would be if the cloning process is one of a suite of tools of assisted reproduction, like artificial insemination or embryo transfer. If these tools could help preserve the continuity of gene pools, then I think they deserve serious consideration.
Dr. Walters, did you want to jump in there?
Yeah. While the technology for the animal cloning is up and coming, plants clone naturally. We call it vegetative propagation. And we have no ethical issues. As a matter of fact, so many of our fruits, and our fruits especially, are clones. For example, a Red Delicious is a cutting. And the seed that comes off of Red Delicious tree is really not going to give you a Red Delicious apple. So the point being is that cloning is a natural part of a plant growth in many, many plants, and we save that particular genotype because it has properties that we use every day in agriculture.
Do you actually have little banks, storage banks with rows and rows of seeds and things in
Well,
there?
We like to put them in liquid nitrogen.
And we have the apple
collection now in liquid nitrogen, so it's not in rows, but
maybe in the old days.
Yeah.
In rows. We're going to take a short break and come back more and talk with our guests. We have Christina Walters, who is the research leader for Germplasm Preservation Research Unit, the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Catherine Kennedy is the president and executive director of the Center for Plant Conservation. That's at the Missouri Botanical Garden in St. Louis. And Oliver Ryder, head of the genetics division at the Center for Reproduction of Endangered Species at the Zoological Society of San Diego. We'll take a short break, and when we come back, we'll take lots more of your questions from the audience, so stay with us. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. We're talking this hour about preserving an endangered species. Endangered species is the topic of this hour with my guests, Christina Walters, Catherine Kennedy, and Oliver Ryder. When I left, Dr. Walters was telling me about preserving all those different seeds. It's a complicated process, I understand. It's not just as simple as dunking it in that cold liquid air, is it?
Well, it's my job, so of course it's complicated.
Okay. Now we have your boss listening. He knows you're getting paid the right amount. Tell us about how that's done.
The process of preservation is really trying to manipulate cells so that they go into a state of suspended animation, as Oliver Ryder said. Usually we, in seeds are pretty remarkable. Most plants are remarkable in that they have that ability by themselves. And what they do is they dry down naturally. And when they dry down naturally, they can survive the cold. And so we can easily put them in. There are a lot of other species that aren't as amenable to that, and they're sensitive to both the drying and the cold. And so we trick them by cooling them very, very rapidly and then storing them in liquid nitrogen.
Sneaky people that you are. Let's go to the questions. Let me go to the back here. Step right up to the microphone.
My name is Mary from Texas Military Institute in San Antonio, Texas. For the past 10 years, my students and I have been monitoring a rare plant species in the Texas Hill Country. And I'd like for Catherine, if you could, to tell us about the importance of citizen scientist projects in keeping up with these species throughout the United States.
Monitoring in general is a very high need because we need to track these sites and these populations and basically watch how they're doing, whether they're in decline, whether they're stable. It helps us make management decisions. It helps us decide if what we're doing is appropriate. And it's a big load. It's a big labor load. There's design work that goes into it at the professional level, but there is a need for field technicians to help with that, and there's room for volunteer assistance. That said, endangered species sites are often quite sensitive, and so it's a balancing act to find the right people. It takes a fair amount of training and a commitment to having minimal impact when you're on the site. So to me, it's very exciting work to be in an area where you know you're working with a unique resource. And throughout the network, in our 33 institutions, we have literally thousands of volunteers that help us with monitoring, seed cleaning, planting out projects. We couldn't do a lot of the restoration work that we do if we didn't have our core of volunteers helping us out.
Well, I'm going to ask the question that we're going to get the email on later, which is, how do I become a volunteer? And do you need people as volunteers, or do you have too many already?
It depends completely on the institution. There are heritage programs that are working with rare plants in addition to the Center for Plant Conservation's institution. So what I would say you need to do is to contact your state and federal botanists who are working with rare plants or your local CPC institution. We do have 33 of them. They're pretty well dispersed around the United States. You can visit our website at www.centerforplantconservation.org. There's a list of all of our institutions and all of the plants that they work with. And contact that institution and ask them what they've got going on and if they can use your help. Chances are they can.
Here you go. Let's go up here to this microphone.
Hi, my name's Rick. I'm from University of Colorado Boulder. And I have a larger question. If I'm not mistaken, most scientists are in agreement that we're going through the largest mass extinction in history. Why is it that the public seems to know so little about it and seems somewhat indifferent to it?
We knew a lot about Monica Lewinsky, so I don't understand that question. Christina, do you want to answer that question, or Kathleen? Or go to Oliver. Go ahead.
Well, I don't think the public's real indifferent to it. I don't think that they're fully informed. That's why shows like this can be so important. But we have 3.5 million people a year visit the San Diego Zoo and Wild Animal Park, and we're the largest zoological society in the world with 250,000 member households, and it's important that we know what the attitudes of our members are. And there's a deep concern there. One of the most important questions people ask is, what can I do? They feel it's an overwhelming kind of issue. And what can one person do? And so I think in response to that kind of tidal wave of despair, that makes it difficult to mobilize action. But in fact, we are part of the solution as we are part of the problem, and people are making an enormous difference. We just heard about volunteers monitoring rare plants. Our changes in our lifestyle, this show's had a lot of talk about global warming. There's an issue about resource uses. It's a larger picture question, and it's a question that especially children are both interested in and make a big impact on their families. families that recycle largely do so because the kids say we should recycle. So it's much can be done.
Catherine Kennedy, I know you've had some success with, what is it, the robin sink foil?
Yes.
Tell us about that.
That is a species that one of our institutions, the New England Wildflower Society, was working on, along with the National Park Service and the Fish and Wildlife Service and a local trails conservation group. And it is a plant that was only known from three sites on the top of Mount Washington in New Hampshire. It's on parkland.
That's the worst weather site in the country.
It's a very rigorous environment. Very windy, very cold, very dry.
It's rigorous, I like that.
Very, very rigorous. And there were only a few hundred plants known from three small sites. And one of the major threats was that there was a trail system that went through the populations. And because many of these cold, arid systems are slow to recover from disturbance, trampling was a problem for the species. So the New England Wildflower Society propagated the plants. The trail group helped to reroute the trail. The Park Service went through their policy process of getting all of that work done. We've worked with that species now for more than 12 years. And at present, there are over 14,000 plants in five sites, and the Fish and Wildlife Service felt like the populations were robust enough that it was removed from the endangered species list in August. It will continue to be monitored for 5 years. The New England Wildflower Society is continuing to put plants in to further secure the populations. But I think it really shows the potential of what can be done with this banked material that we have collected, propagated, and put into restoration programs to get the species back up.
But it took a whole village to save that.
It does take a whole village. It's a very complicated process. Recovery for plants, and I'm sure for animals too, is not a quick thing, and that has been one of the things that's been hard for us to get across to the American people. You know, we're a nation of gardeners, and we really like to grow things, and we like to grow annuals. We like to have them, you know, blooming and beautiful in a year. But plant recovery is more complicated than that. You have to learn a lot about the species. You have to figure out how to germinate it, how to grow it, you know, what is its environment, what is it going to take to keep it fine-tuned. So it's more complicated than people think, and Americans, we like that instant gratification. We don't like to hear that it's going to take us 20 years to solve the problem, but sometimes it does.
We like 20 minutes. Let's go to the back there. Yes, go ahead.
I'm George from Denver, and with all this talk about saving the species, I'm old enough to remember I was 10 years old when the United States dropped a nuclear bomb on Japan. And as a 10-year-old, what we were worried about was all the radiation and all the things that it could do to you, and we may be going through that again. Since it's Valentine's Day, I'd like to sing you all a verse from a song we used to sing to each other back in the 40s.
Is this going to be about plants or something else?
It's direct.
Okay,
about humans.
Is this going to be broadcastable, this song?
Okay, it's broadcastable.
Okay.
And we used to sing, our children may be purple, green, or blue. Though I'm radioactive, I'm in love with you. Happy Valentine's Day.
Thank you very much. I think there's a Fox show somewhere for him. let me ask you, Dr. Ryder, tell us about the... there's an extinct species you're studying. Was it, is it a quagga? I can't even pronounce the name. The quagga. It's related to the zebra.
The quagga is a kind of an interesting conservation story. It's a poignant one. It was once the most. It was the first zebra-like animal described by Western scientists. It was described from Cape Province in Africa, and it was once the most numerous zebra-like animal in its environment, but it went extinct. It's a species we know the exact date it went extinct, because the last one died in a zoo August 12, 1883. And in spite of it being so numerous, there are really only about a dozen skins and fewer skeletal specimens remaining from this animal. And it had the coloration, the front end of it was striped more like a zebra, and the back end of it tended to be unstriped or even brown like a horse. So there was some conjecture about what kind of animal was it. And that really wasn't possible to study by any means with so little material, or at least there were still controversies that existed. about that.
What kind of sound did it make, if I might ask?
Well, I knew you were going to ask me this. You see, the quagga is onomatopoetic because it was actually named by the kind of vocalization it made. So it was like the bark of a zebra. Quah-ha! Quah-ha!
Very good. Very good. Will a zoo be getting one of those?
No, the quagga was the first extinct organism to have its genes cloned. This was even in the days before PCR. But in the 150th anniversary of a museum in Germany, they had a very skilled South African taxonomist come and remount their quagga skin. And when he did it, he discovered a good job hadn't been done in the first place. And there was like quagga jerky left on the inside of the skin, and he wrote to me and asked me if I thought it would be useful for in some of the questions involved in understanding what the quagga was, and I was sure it was, but not exactly sure how. But then in collaboration with other scientists, who we basically able to get the DNA out of that extinct organism and do some early DNA sequencing on an extinct animal.
Let me go to a question right here.
Hi, my name is Lise. I'm with the American Medical Association, and I was wondering what your view is on the Bush administration's policies that they're opening up more preserved lands to vehicles and possibly other pollutants. Is this going to affect how many plants and animals are being endangered currently?
Catherine Kennedy?
I think that that's a very difficult question to answer in a general sense. There's no doubt that we have concerns about our resource policies and that we proceed in a responsible manner. It is always a balancing act in a multiple-use resource environment to say that various ideas about how a piece of property might be used or a resource might be used need to be balanced against the potential loss of that natural resource. And I think what we're seeing happen is that we've opened a new dialogue in this country about how we're going to do that. And I think all of us need to be a part of that dialogue and make it clear that natural resources are a priority for us and that we do want conservation of those as for the legacy that they represent for future generations. And it will be not a philosophical decision, it will be a national policy decision about what happens and how we proceed. So that's a complicated thing in this country, as we all know. We have legislation, we have regulation, we have policy, we have implementation. Keeping it up with all of it can be a daunting task, but I encourage every citizen to do so, because the ultimate sustainability of our natural resource base in this country depends on finding that right balance and not letting resources go unnecessarily.
We're talking about saving endangered species this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Dr. Ryder, we hear all the time, you know, that people are, you talked about the quagga jerky, but we always hear, you know, when Jurassic Park was around, and we hear stories about mammoth bones being found, and people saying, why don't you try to bring back the dinosaurs or the woolly mammoths or the extinct species? Why don't you try to do that kind of stuff?
I think for me, the rightful priority is that we ought to try to accomplish a better effort to conserve what we have here now that is dwindling in our presence, basically, that we're party to. To preserve species that are part of functioning ecosystems, to keep those ecosystems intact, rather than to bring back something that really isn't adapted to live in the world. And I really don't believe in Jurassic Park is a wonderful story. I don't believe in it as a resurrection technology, and I don't think that that it would be very useful beyond what it was portrayed to be, which was a kind of an amusement.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the questioner right in the back there. Yes, sir. Step up to the mic. Yeah.
My name is Klaus, and I am from Switzerland, chairing the Red List Project of Europe for the IUCN. And Monday, I'm starting a sabbatical in Missouri Botanical Garden, one of the world's leading places in systematics. And that's my question. What are you going to do about the threatened species of taxonomists? Because conservation is after all a thing about knowing the plants and the animals out in the field.
Welcome your colleague.
You've got a very good point, and it's not just in the plant world that we are experiencing a loss of expert people who can help us identify and study and make the prescriptions for what we need to do to save our biodiversity in this country and worldwide. And it's a phenomenon that's been going on for many years. It is reaching crisis proportions for some of our species groups. And I think the answer to that, as many things, is increased public awareness and an increased request for our academic institutions and our research institutes to serve those needs. Science, while inquiry is very broad, also responds to fads and to new ideas and trends. It's kind of the nature of the beast to follow the new idea. But it's very important that we not shift all of our endeavor into, say, molecular work, much as it is a valuable tool. Whole organism biology is still extremely important to our country and to science in general. And I have seen in my career, the pendulum swing away from whole organism biology toward more cell science and more molecular science.
How do you tell somebody in college, hey, you know, get away from this exciting new field of cell biology and become a taxonomist?
Well, you know, I've had a great time. And, you know, I wouldn't switch my career with anybody for anything. I've had, you know, 20 years in the field. I've had 10 years in the federal government. I'm on my fifth year in nonprofit. And it's a very rewarding career.
How would somebody go into that career if they're listening to the program?
There are environmental programs in many universities, and you just need to get on the net, that wonderful information source, and investigate those areas of your own interest and see what you can do and who you can train with that would give you those skills.
All right, we're going to take a short break, come back and talk lots more with Catherine Kennedy, Oliver Ryder, and Christina Walters, and take more of your questions from the audience talking about species and preservations of species and their biodiversity. So don't go away. We'll be right back after the short break. Welcome back to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. We're talking this hour about preserving endangered species with my guest, Christina Walters, research leader for the Plant Germplasm Preservation Research Unit at the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Fort Collins, Colorado. Catherine Kennedy is president and executive director of the Center for Plant Conservation. That's at the Missouri Botanical Garden in St. Louis. Oliver Ryder is the head of the genetics division at the Center for Reproduction of Endangered Species at the San Diego Zoo. And we're talking about these diversity of species. Let me ask you a question about what happens when, you know, I remember for many years living through devastating things like Dutch elm disease. They wipe out. I mean, can you recover from something like that? Is there a way to? I see both of you shaking your heads. Christina, you want to answer that first?
Sure. That's the point, is to preserve the genetic diversity so that when you do have a disease, you have the genes available so that you can breed to make them resistant.
Can you bring back a tree like that by breeding?
Well, you can't bring back dead stuff.
Well, I don't mean the dead tree itself, but God, am I looking bad today. I have to go back and practice asking these questions. But you know what I mean, right?
Yeah, well, we, what you're asking is, it's not so much about a species, it's about creating a genotype that is more resistant to bad things that can happen in the world. And that's the reason why we want to preserve genetic diversity, because animals and plants and all organisms do it themselves, but things happen very quickly. And if we can, by agriculture or by breeding, we can do it for them.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the, where are we? Are we up front? We'll start at the back and work our way forward. Yes, go ahead, sir.
Hi, my name is John from Denver. And I was wondering, do you know of any species that might be currently threatened due to natural means, such as predation or overgrazing by animals in the wild, or is it pretty much man-induced?
The rate of vulnerable, or the number of vulnerable species that we see today and the rate of decline is definitely predominantly caused by the activities of man. And anyone who would tell you otherwise, I think, is not living in the real world. In the United States today, we have impacted 70% of the land area of this country's native plant population areas with our ongoing activities. That said, there are cases where natural forces exert stress on populations. Teasing out whether that population has also got stressors from man's activities that are aggravating its condition is where you get into some problems. But we definitely have species that are being browsed by deer. The question is, are there more deer now than there were before because of the way we manage the land? It's a natural native animal. Is the impact natural or unnatural?
They're in my backyard. I'll tell
That's you. Right. And so we have species that were once, if you look at geologic time, were once much more widespread because of climate change. And they're hanging on. I can think of several in Texas. In cool, mesic spots in canyons, and they're not as widespread as they were in more mesic times, but they're still here. They're still a resource. They're still viable. And I'm not in any hurry to discount their conservation needs because perhaps the primary forces might be not man-caused. But it's a very small number of species. Most of them are impacted by man. Habitat destruction, invasive species, those kinds of activities are the major threat to our biodiversity today.
Oliver Ryder, same story with animals?
I think I agree very much with Dr. Kennedy. The California condor is a flagship species, and it's been declining for 10,000 years, probably as the large prey species like giant sloths and mastodons and beached whales. Now most of the beachfront is high-priced real estate, and people don't like to have decomposing whales in their vicinity, and they're hauled off. But so there was a natural decline of condors. On the other hand, it's very clear that that's been exacerbated and accelerated by human forces, the most important of which now is just lead in the environment.
Let me ask all three of you. You touched on climate change a bit. Are we seeing a shift now? Are species, are they changing around, some going becoming extinct, some becoming more robust?
We are definitely seeing changes in the plant side, and I'm sure we probably are on the animal side too. I hope I've answered that. But we have species that are coming into flower sooner, earlier in the year than they used to. They're fruiting earlier. We have species that have not successfully set seed in many years because we're having deeper droughts and more localized high temperatures. So I don't know that I can say that we're at the point where we're seeing wholesale change in geographic distribution, but I think that those kinds of responses are expected.
I know there are stories. I live in New England of maple trees moving up to Canada because they need the cold and they're not getting it anymore.
Yeah, we will see a shift to the extent that the plants themselves are able to move, and, of course, that depends on if the pollinators can move and if the seed dispersers can move. Plants don't pick up their skirts and take off. You know, they need to have those other forces in the environment operating with them, and they are governing how they're distributed. So we'll see.
Dr. Ryder, you wanted to say something?
It's birds are also, bird migrations are changing. The appearance of birds in the spring and some overwintering populations, those are some indications as well.
All right, let's go to this patient gentleman right here.
I'm Marty at New York University. Given the vulnerability of the biological diversity of the present Earth's biosphere and the fact that these species could easily, or that have in the past, apparently become extinct through mass extinctions generated by asteroid impacts and other astronomical phenomenon, I wonder how the panel would feel about establishing a branch of the Library of Life, which you're just beginning to develop, elsewhere in the solar system, perhaps on the moon or other planets, as a way of ensuring the survival to future generations. Thank you.
Should we put a seed bank on the moon or a frozen zoo on the moon? Well, it'd be easy to freeze it up there, Ellen.
We've actually talked about this, and I don't think that I can give you an exactly an exactly a clear answer. One thing that I can say in the broader perspective of that is when you talk about a library of life, or what sounds to me like is some kind of central repository, and the human experience with creating a central repositories that work over long periods of time isn't very good. What's really tended to work more is to have lots of copies that are redundant in multiple locations. And in that regard, if humans would want to bank some materials on the moon, I think that's it's a subject of some science fiction. I think it'd be very interesting to have a discussion. What would we choose to send and why?
Okay, I'm all for that. Not right now, but we'll do that later. Christina Walters, what about, I mentioned at the beginning of the program, preserving seeds for 1,000 years. How do you do that?
Well,
very carefully, you're going to say. I know you're going to say that.
No, the best way to do it is to dry them out and lower the temperature. It's the same principles that you use for your food in the refrigerator.
Freeze drying.
No, you don't. No. You don't have to. You can dry them out and then cool them. Freeze drying is both, but it's really about the storage temperature, and so that's why we have a lot of refrigerators and we use liquid nitrogen, and things stay very cold for a very long time.
And as far as the moon trip, weighing in on that one?
My own philosophy is that gene banks are there to be used, and if you put it far away, and assuming that there was a massive destruction, so our rockets were also put far away, they're not going to be there for us. And so I believe in keeping it right here and keeping them available so that we can have them.
Use it or lose it?
Well, get it so that you have it.
Okay. I'm trying to come up with a slogan for you to get this rolling here, but obviously not. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flato here in Denver. We're talking about gene banks, preserving biodiversity and seeds and all kinds of stuff. I was here next. I'll go back here next. Yes, go ahead.
Hi, I'm Randy from Madison, Connecticut. No one likes the idea of life forms going extinct, but for those of us who are not scientists, I was just wondering if you might lay out specifically what the risks are of losing plants and animals. They're not preserving themselves naturally. You mentioned genetic diversity. Could you say something more about that and how that might be beneficial?
Maybe an example would be the most helpful. I did an overview of the recovery plans in the United States, and I found that 74% of the listed plant species in the United States today, the majority of the remaining sites have fewer than 100 individuals. And in general population modeling and genetic work, we know that when we reach population levels that are that small, we have a very high vulnerability to extinction. Either from, say, that lightning strike or that little forest fire, that they would be able to survive if the population were larger. And we call that a stochastic event. If something like that happens to a small population, it's curtains. They won't be able to recover. Similarly, when we reach small populations like that, we start having internal genetic erosion. We lose viability. Embryos don't form properly. Plants may stop reproducing in the wild. They may stop setting seed. And so we have real problems and real vulnerability when we get to small populations like that. When you look at what the risk of extinction is, we believe for most of these plants that if we don't get interventions started within 20 to 25 years, they will be gone. Now, if we get intervention started, we can substantially extend that time frame to get the rest of the work done. But if we don't start, they will be gone within 20 to 25 years.
But I'm going to play devil's advocate here, because you always hear some people who say, so what? I mean, that's survival of the fittest. Why should we be intervening in nature here? Oh, I got that laugh. I hate it when I get that laugh. You silly boy.
I don't buy it. Now, I know everybody here knows that I have a bias, but, you know, the preamble of the Endangered Species Act is a wonderful document, and it talks about the values that Congress has declared are really important to the nation and our people. And they talk about the scientific significance and the ecological significance and their aesthetic value and their historical value and their recreational value. The Endangered Species Act doesn't even talk about economic value. But for plants, it is a tremendous frontier. Every single one of those evolved species has unique metabolic compounds. They've got adaptations to their habitat. I mean, frankly, the resources that we have in our arid lands in this country are going to be pretty important to us as global warming reaches the proportions that we think it will in this country. And it makes absolutely no sense to me to say that this is a natural process and that we should let these natural resources go, because extinction is natural for something somewhere. The rates we have are not normal. And the resources are way too valuable to take that kind of cavalier attitude toward them.
We only have a minute or so left. Are you all optimistic about preserving species, or do we have a long way to go? Christine is making a face like, oh, we have a way to go on this. Are you optimistic?
I'm very, it's a proof of concept. We can do it. It's done. It's probably the least expensive way to do it, but we mustn't forget the habitat.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Ryder?
Well, people can make a difference. It's the decisions and behavior of people that's going to make the difference about what we save. One of the ways of looking at the gene banking is it preserves this legacy, something that would otherwise be lost. It's a legacy that I think the future would want us to save.
And I'm sure I know what Catherine is going to say. But
I know we can do it. There's not a doubt in my mind. We have 80 restoration projects going on across the country right now with plant material that is in our national collection. We have 606 species that we have plant material for that are held in our institutions. And we have 50 projects right now where we are reintroducing the plant material into the wild. Hmm. And we just delisted robin stinkfoil. I mean, we know that we can do this. A lot of the work is still experimental, but I believe that we will learn the techniques that we need. And if we have the plant material, we will get there. If there's a will, we can make it happen technically.
All right.
Technically.
No better way to end on that comment. I'd like to thank all my guests this hour. Catherine Kennedy, President and Executive Director of the Center for Plant Conservation, hosted by the Missouri Botanical Garden in St. Louis. Christina Walters, Research Leader for the Plant Germplasm Preservation Research Unit at the U.S. Department of Agriculture's National Center for Genetic Resources Preservation, and Oliver Ryder, the head of the Genetics Division and Center for Reproduction of Endangered Species at the San Diego Zoo. Thank you all for running down here and taking time to join us today.
I enjoyed it.
Our program is produced by Annette Heist and senior producer Karen Vergoth. Charles Berquist is our director and web producer. Our intern is Adrian McDonald, and our volunteer is Christina Rombaitis Del Rio. If you'd like to write us, please send your letters to Talk of the Nation Science Friday, 1221 6th Avenue, 364 New York, New York, 10020. Or surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. We can leave us email, and we also have a free curricula there for your taking and suggestions for using Science Friday as a teaching tool for your teacher. We have all this kind of information stored there. This is Ira Flato in Denver.